for listening to WORT 89.9 FM in Madison, Wisconsin. Listener-supported community radio and WORT HD.
WORT thanks its listener sponsors and Heartland Credit Union, a full-service community financial cooperative owned by more than 15,000 members. Offices are downtown at the corner of Bedford and West Washington, in the Third Lake Market on Williamson Street, in Verona and Dodgeville, on the web at heartlandcu.org. Federally insured by NCUA.
Hello and welcome to A Public Affair on WORT. This is David Devereaux Weber. It's I'm going to make noise here. Thank you. It's wonderful to follow Chris Powers. And we're going to be talking today about community networks. So we're talking about, I was one of the people who helped the city of Madison out with their application to get Google Fiber in. And we're hoping to get Google Fiber, but our chances for Google Fiber are about 1 in 1,100, so not very well. But I've been sort of passionate about community fiber optic networks for some time, so we'll talk about that in a minute. do we have a guest? Our guest today is Christopher Mitchell. And Christopher is with the New Rules Project up in Minneapolis, Minnesota. And they study things like this. And Chris wrote a paper about how communities are building the networks they need. Interestingly, one of the closest community networks we have in Madison is right out in Sun Prairie, where they have a fiber optic network. So, Chris, are you with us?
I am.
Wonderful. Good to have you on the air. How long have you been doing this kind of analysis work?
Well, I've been working on the municipal and broader community ownership of networks for 3 years. I was finishing off my Master's of Public Policy prior to that.
Great. And what brought you to looking into public fiber networks?
Well, I've always been fascinated with technology, and I've worked behind the scenes in a lot of different capacities, and as we came to realize that these networks are the key to the future in terms of communication and just being able to spread media around, just became a much more interesting subject, and I became concerned with the role that some of the private companies play in terms of gatekeeper, a lot of those the network neutrality discussion, and other concerns spring out of that. And so when we looked at this, we said these networks are incredibly important. They need to be make sure that the networks are responsive to the public interest, and that private companies can't just decide the future of a community without any input from the community. So that's what brought us to this subject, I guess.
I would like to comment that listeners can call in. This is WORT. This is one of our wonderful public affairs shows, and you can call in and participate in the discussion. The number here is 256-2001. I'm also on Twitter right now, so if you tweet me at DaveDW, you can send me a Twitter message. As we get questions, we'll be able to answer them. Christopher, one of the things that's led me to the conclusion that community fiber, community-owned networks are the way to go is the whole geometric rise in the amount of traffic, and at the same time, the costs only go up at a linear rate, and so the cost of internet service actually goes down over time. And so while in the early days of the internet, private ownership of networks made sense and made a lot of people wealthy, but as this curve relentlessly continues upwards, it won't make sense for for-profit companies to be operating internet networks. Had you had any thoughts in that area?
Yes, I have, and I think it depends on where you're located as to just how rapidly the ownership of these networks by private companies makes your life more difficult. And I say that in terms of it, we see that cable companies in urban areas like the Twin Cities where I am, and I'm guessing where you are in Madison, they're more willing to invest in fiber closer to the user. They're not going to put it all the way to the user in the home, but they're willing to invest in faster networks in urban areas, whereas people in more rural areas, they are more stuck with slower networks. And so for them, I think this is an issue today, and for people in urban areas, it may be a bigger issue in the near future. But it's definitely true that the amount of usage of these networks is going up rapidly, and the companies would prefer to just take that money that they're making, and rather than invest in faster networks and making sure that the future networks are able to meet demand and that we can continue to innovate with new applications, they're just giving that to shareholders, or they're retaining it, and they're not putting it back into the communities that need it. And I think this is tremendously important, because this is what we would expect private companies to do. It's not to say that they're evil. It's just to say that this is the nature of a private company. They exist to make a profit, and they're not going to invest in the well-being of these communities absent a reassurance they're going to make a lot of money. And so I would guess that the connectivity that you're listeners have probably pales in comparison to what people get in Reedsburg. Just, I believe it's northwest of Madison.
Right.
I've actually been out there, and it's an excellent network. They have much faster speeds at lower prices than I can get here in the Twin Cities. And it's fascinating to me that here in the upper Midwest, you know, Chicago, Madison, St. Paul, Minneapolis, our speeds are all pretty low compared to some of the publicly owned networks we have surrounding us in smaller communities.
It's interesting, because I think that the for-profit companies in Madison, they're companies like AT&T and Charter and TDS, TDS the phone company, they sincerely believe that privately owned for-profit networks is the only way to go, and that that government ownership of anything is bad, and especially of networks. But on the other hand, in my day job, I work at the University of Wisconsin, where I'm a network engineer, and where we build and operate very fast fiber optic networks. And it's stunning how low costs can go when you engineer things right and build things right. So I'm not sure that the phone companies are going to be able to follow in those footsteps, because, as we're saying here, they want to see that profit. They want to see return on their investment. And that's going to be a challenge as time goes by.
Absolutely. And I think one of the key elements there is that because AT&T and Charter know that people have so few choices and where they can go, they don't have to invest that money. And so my guess is that probably the speeds there from Charter are probably faster than what AT&T offers. I don't know how comparative it is here in the Twin Cities. The Comcast speeds are much faster than Quest. And so for those of us that care about high-speed broadband, we have one option. And if you're willing to settle for a slightly slower speed, you have a second option for broadband. That's over the DSL. And so to the extent that these companies are the only choices, then they have all the power to make these decisions. And that's really harming of the communities in many cases, I think, because if you're trying to figure out where you want to raise your family or where you want to work or if you want to start a business or expand a business, you're not going to pick a place where you have to pay way too much for the key utility of the next century.
One of the fascinating things about watching how the network is used at the university, where I've worked for about 15 years now, it changes the way people do business, and it changes the way that people think about business. Nowadays, the university couldn't operate without an internet connection, because people register for classes online, and they look at course offerings online, and they pay their tuition and fees online. And so if the network goes down, it's not just an inconvenience, but it really prevents them from doing day-to-day operations. And it's different than when the internet first started back in the 1990s, and it was more of a an unusual curiosity than something you depended on a daily basis. That change from from being a curiosity to something that you depend on for day-to-day functions is something that I don't think that the ownership of public media, of community networks has caught up with. So I think you're going in the right direction, and it's really nice to see that. One of the problems is that the telephone industry and the cable industry have tried to make it difficult for cities to enter into the municipal network area. Have you studied that at all? Are there different laws in different states, and are there national laws yet?
There are there's different laws in different states, certainly. And so a lot of this actually goes back to the 1996 Telecom Act, when the key language of the was to say that no state or local law could prevent competition from emerging. And so the idea was that we would move from a regulated monopoly environment into a more competitive environment, and that the cities would not be allowed to offer exclusive franchises. And so this is still a matter of confusion. So I just wanted to branch off quickly here to any listeners to realize that in fact there is no law, there's no ability for local governments to prevent another cable company from coming in. The fact that cable companies don't come in and compete is entirely a fact of the nature of these networks, which is that they are natural monopolies. It's incredibly difficult for one private company to compete with another private company, so we're not going to see Comcast overbuilding Charter in Madison. It's not something that the private companies are interested in doing. And so there's this myth that the public sector has in many ways gotten in the way of the private sector from solving this problem with competition, and that's entirely backwards. But unfortunately, that's led a lot of state legislatures to pass laws, often at the behest of companies like AT&T, who have a lot of money to donate to election campaigns and have a lot of influence. And I don't want to make it sound dirty, because there's just a simple fact that every day state legislators hear from lobbyists of these companies, and they maybe hear from consumer advocates once a month, once a year. It's very rare. And so in many cases, the legislators may even be acting in what they think is the best interest just because they get really poor information constantly. But many states, it's under 20, I think it's 18 states, have laws that make it more difficult. Wisconsin's got a couple of laws that do discourage communities from building these networks, but there's not an outright prohibition as there is in four states, Texas, Arkansas, and Nebraska, and Missouri all have entirely prevented communities from building these networks at this point. And there's other states that have more harsh laws. Minnesota has a unique law which is requires a 65% referendum from communities, which is incredibly difficult when the companies are able to dump in hundreds of thousands of dollars in AstroTurf campaigns to confuse people and get they only have to get a minority of people to vote against the idea to prevent it from happening. So it's definitely a major issue with legislatures. I think Wisconsin just recently prevented it from getting worse. There were some bad bills that were up, and I believe those were fought off, so I'm happy to hear that.
I'm not sure if they were fought off as much as the legislature ran out of time to try to implement them, but let's think positively and say they were fought off.
Right. I like to think positively on these issues. It's definitely an issue of us being outgunned, and we have to be nimble, we have to be smart, and we really have to get people engaged to make sure that we don't see it getting worse. I think that when it comes down to it, the only prospect we really have for competition in broadband, and by broadband I'm really talking about the future of television, I'm talking about telephone service, I'm talking about the real future of communications. If we want to have a choice in who we get our services from, then we need to make sure that the public has a voice, that the public is able to build the network if they choose to. And that's just not just because we have an additional choice of a municipal network versus the AT&T network, but because municipal networks, in some cases, and in any case that they choose to, they can allow multiple private companies or independent companies, it could be nonprofits or other organizations, to compete and offer services. And so we can think about networks in the future, and these high-capacity fiber networks sounds like a road. And so just like the road has multiple shipping companies, it has all kinds of different people that use the road for all kinds of different purposes, and I can choose to ship my products with the U.S. Postal Service or with UPS or DHL, I should have a choice in service providers. And so when you have the public sector owning the broadband network, you can really open it up for the private sector to offer services even. And so this isn't a question of whether services should be public or private. It's really a question of whether or not the network is going to allow competition on it or not, and those decisions all come down to who owns the network. That's why I focus entirely on ownership, because everything else that we're talking about here is determined by who owns the network. The owner is going to decide what kind of technology to use. They're going to decide what kind of how many service providers are allowed to operate on it. They're going to decide when it's going to be upgraded. They're going to, in many cases, decide the prices. And so this focus on ownership often gets sidelined, but it's really the key issue for everything else that we'll talk about in this hour.
A long time ago, there was a company by the name of Rochester Telephone Company in Rochester, New York. And one of the interesting things they did was they spun off the wires that went to the homes from the central office part of the company and operated them as two separate companies. They later became Frontier Communications, and that experiment stopped. But I think that that's kind of what you're proposing, is that the wiring system, the cables that go to the neighborhoods and the homes, be a public resource, kind of like those streets and like the water pipes and so on. Is that kind of the idea?
That is exactly the idea. And local government has a terrific history throughout the entire country of providing these essential services. In many cases, I think that we forget, it operates so transparently, we forget how amazing it is that when we turn on our taps, we get water. And it's clean water, and it's drinkable, and we have an almost infinite amount of it coming to us, and we have to pay relatively low rates for it. I spent a month in Africa, and among a number of other things, it really became apparent that we take a lot of things for granted. And similarly with electricity, the cost of electricity is so incredibly low relative to its utility, and that is a key effort of good government policies, whether you're getting your service from a network, a grid that's owned by the public, or whether your services or your prices are just kept low because of regulations that prevent companies from overcharging for the service. These aspects of our life, these key utilities, are all heavily controlled by good government policies. And this is what we need to bring to bear in terms of broadband. And so one way would certainly be, and I think it's the best way, for the local governments to build these networks and then to operate them just as they have the roads, the pipes, and the electrical grid. In certain cases,
The current companies in telephone and cable TV now are trying to offer the triple play of a television service, an internet service, and a voice service. Would a community network have that kind of approach?
Most do, and so in most of the cases in which communities have done this, as is the case in Reedsburg, The local utility does offer all three services, and they typically do it at much higher capacity than the private sector because they're using a more advanced network. And so because the public has built its network more recently and they've invested in a faster network because they're more interested in benefiting the community than they are in turning a quick profit, they can offer faster broadband, they can often do it at lower prices, and in many cases they can offer much clearer HD pictures. And depending on who the competition is, they may be offering more channels. Then there's an alternative model in which the city offers the network available to multiple third parties. And so in the case of one network in Utah and a couple of networks in Washington State, the community has built the network, and then there's a lot of private companies that offer telephone, television, and broadband services over it. And then there's yet another model, which is used in Monticello, Minnesota, and Powell, Wyoming, which are both smaller communities, but the community built the network, and then they licensed it to one provider who offers the services, and those are overseen by the local government to make sure that they're not abusing their position of power. So there's a couple of different ways of approaching it, but the most common one is where the local government does offer the services.
In an interesting twist, when we were trying to drum up interest in the Google Fiber application for the city of Madison, I approached Charter and AT&T and asked them if Google chooses Madison, which is an outside chance, but if they did, would those respective companies be interested in being a provider on the network? I think that Google's network would not be a triple play type network. It would be an IP-only network. But and they did want to open themselves up to anybody who wanted to be an ISP on the network. So they would operate a backbone network, but they would not connect to the outside world. You'd have to use an outside company to do that. And that approach confused both the local AT&T people and the local Charter people. So I think that if a network starts, if either a municipal project starts or a co-op project starts or whatever, the Google project starts, I think the companies will come along quickly because the threat will be more imminent. But it is very interesting to see the responses I got. So.
Right, and I think in many cases they wouldn't have a choice. And so the local people for AT&T and Charter may say, oh, yes, I think we should take advantage of this very fast network, but they would be overruled by the people over them in the company. And we have seen this happen in other cases where local governments have said, and it's actually a truism that in almost every case before a local government builds a network, they go to the providers and say, we need better services, will you provide them? And then the companies, whether it's Quest, Comcast, AT&T, Verizon, Charter, they all have the same answer, which is to say, oh, we think you're doing just fine with the services you have. You wouldn't know what to do with faster speeds. It's a very condescending response.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And then in some cases where the local government has built a network and invited them on, a local person from, at least in one case, Comcast, has been very interested in the idea, and they understand the local dynamics. But then a vice president above them says, absolutely not. We're not going to encourage any alternative model. We need to own the customer.
Mm-hmm.
And that's exactly how they view it. They view it as owning the customer. You want to limit the customer's choices because if the customer has no other choices, then you can do anything you want to them, and they will continue to subscribe for the most part.
We're talking with Christopher Mitchell today about public broadband networks. And this is WORT-FM in Madison, Wisconsin. You can call us if you'd like to add a comment or ask a question, 256-2001. One of the questions in our local group discussing these issues is a local co-op an option, and would that sidestep the problem of state law that would make would require a referendum at the city level?
Absolutely. And so there's positives and negatives in terms of taking a co-op approach. And one of the things that I've worked on here in St. Paul with a local group is a similar idea, where they would form a neighborhood co-op and run fiber locally and find some means of connecting to the wider Internet, and they would have much faster connections. However, that approach is you need a real dedicated group of people to pull it off, in part because there's so many regulations around the voice services and in terms of 9/11 connectivity, 911, and as well as with video. And so a co-op like that would almost certainly only offer raw broadband, which is fine for a number of people. But when you're looking at the non-technical people, in many cases they also want to have a home phone service. Less so every day, it seems. More and more people turn to their cell phones. But in many cases, they want to be able to get channel packages, especially with the future of Hulu being uncertain. It may start costing money. They may not have as many shows. It's a little premature for some people to cut the cord and go to only broadband. So the co-op approach is great for people who are happy to just get only broadband. You can get much faster. But then it also comes down to how many people can you get together. Are you able to get on the telephone poles in order to gain access to the telephone poles to get your fiber to the subscribers you have? You may need to do a number of utility requests. You may need to be a formal organization that takes a lawyer. So you may have significant startup costs. And so I would say that it's definitely possible, but there's costs involved, and there are upfront costs that may be uncertain, and so you have to find people that are willing to put in money for it. But we are seeing more communities experiment with different ideas like this. And I think we're just going to see more and more of that because cities like Madison are going to be tremendously underserved because Verizon isn't operating there. And so major cities like Madison, which are competing with major cities on the coast, Madison's at a disadvantage because a lot of the coastal cities and suburbs have gotten Verizon fiber optic next generation networks. And so their businesses and their residents can get much faster speeds than people in Madison will be able to. So I think you'll see more interest among people. I mean, as you told me when we talked about this briefly before, you found a lot more people interested in Google Fiber than I think you expected to. And I think that a lot of these communities that have experimented or tried to attract Google Fiber, they're going to be interested in finding something if they're not chosen by Google. And so I think the co-op approach is something that will be dynamic and changing, and we'll learn a lot over the next couple of years in terms of ways to approach it and problems that can arise from it.
There was a Minnesota case in which there was a municipal network. I don't know if it was Monticello or another one, and then the local telephone company sued them and blocked them for a time. Is that Monticello or is that another one?
It was Monticello. I followed that extremely closely. The hair on the back of my neck stood up a little bit when you said local telephone company. They were actually TDS, which may be local to Madison. That's where they're headquartered, I understand. But they definitely did sue the local government there in Monticello. They made a number of just frivolous charges, and the lawsuit was tossed out of every court. Tossed out of the district court, or tossed out of the appeals court, and the Supreme Court of Minnesota tossed it out at the earliest opportunity in each case because there was no real charge. It was just an attempt to delay the city for 1 year. They succeeded in that, and they delayed the city, and they cost the city a fair amount of money. However, Monticello's network is being deployed, and I believe they'll be turning on customers for the full triple play in the near future, in the next couple of weeks. They're already offering broadband in significant parts of the city. And it's been a tremendous success. Monticello has the fastest speeds for the lowest prices you can find in the upper Midwest. And they may be the second fastest network in the entire country. And when I say that the first fastest network for affordable prices, citywide, you're looking at 10 megabit per second symmetrical for under $30 a month in Louisiana in one community, Lafayette. Monticello comes very close to that. And their speeds, I believe you can get 100 megabit in Monticello for under $100 a month, which is insane.
That is. And
it's incredible.
Ironically, if you buy the wholesale internet correctly, your costs are not very high. It's astounding. Now, you mentioned Lafayette, Louisiana. Do you want to talk a little bit about that? From what I understood, they did a fascinating public relations campaign where they asked citizens to create their own videos about the company. Had you heard that?
Right. Yes, they have. There's this terrific video. And if you go on my site, muninetworks.org, where I write about this stuff on a near daily basis, we cover these networks around the entire country. There's a video on there that one of the people did create. And Lafayette is just a fascinating, fascinating community. It's Cajun country. It's a very unique culture. And they really don't like it when they're put down by outsiders. And so when Bell South and Cox Communications both started attacking Lafayette at the idea of this network, it really drew the community together. And they had.
Can we hang on just a second? We got a call on the line one. So
sure.
Let's get back to that in just a second. Go ahead, caller.
No, I was just listening to the show. It's very interesting, but I was wondering how does the U.S. model compare to other nations? Are there other nations that are giving the fastest speeds and encouraging a different model that allows consumers to get faster speeds? And you did actually answer the second question I had, which was what was the speed of Lafayette and the one in Minnesota. I'll take my answer off the air. Thanks.
Thank you.
Sure, the U.S. is slowly falling behind other nations. And what I may have fragmented earlier when I was saying about the 96 Telecom Act is that we started this approach where we said those who own the wires will have to share them. And this was a relatively unique approach. And over the course of the next number of years, the telephone companies, everyone who owned the wires, said, we don't want to share them. They fought back using all kinds of regulatory means and whatnot. And so then when President Bush was in office, his FCC basically gave up on the idea. And so we don't have competition. Meanwhile,
well, we do have competition in copper, but not on fiber.
Right. So when I say competition, I mean really robust competition. I mean, we have Coke versus Pepsi, but we don't really have a tremendous choice in terms of what we can have. We have slow DSL, and we have somewhat faster cable in most communities. But when I'm talking about competition, I'm talking about in areas of Japan, in France, in Scandinavian countries, where South Korea, there's a lot more competition. And so you can choose between many more providers, and they're all offering much faster speeds or a variety of services.
Can you give some examples of the speeds?
So in, the one that's been trumpeted about among us policy geeks is I think it's now 1 gigabit per second in Hong Kong for $12 a month. It had been 100 megabit per second for $12 a month. Just ridiculously faster speeds at much slower prices. And so in Japan it's similar. I think the amount that they pay per megabit when you average across all the advertised prices and whatnot is 5 times lower than what we pay. And not only that, but we're talking about what they advertise, what they actually deliver versus what we advertise here. And we all know that what AT&T advertises is not what they deliver. And so it's a skewed comparison even then. But the differences are very big, and they're growing because these other countries are investing in fiber, and we're not. And so even though our copper has gotten a little bit faster over the last 5 or 10 years, their strides are much bigger, and their improvements are they're capable of making much greater improvements because they've invested in this key infrastructure.
Yeah, copper or coax will never approach fiber in terms of bandwidth. There's just no way it can do that. So
that's right. And so to answer the question, these other countries are doing much better. In many cases, they're using the policies that we pioneered and we gave up on. And so we are relatively unique. There's a terrific study that was done by the Berkman Center at Harvard that looked at all kinds of international policies and what's worked. And this was done for the FCC's National Broadband Plan. It's available on the Internet if you were to Google something like Berkman Study National Broadband Plan. And it showed exactly that these plans all work terrifically, that they're creating competition at much faster speeds, and it requires more good government policy. And we've refused to embrace that in the United States. We've continued to rely on the copper networks of a number of these companies that are very powerful. And I think it's to our detriment. I think that the U.S. will continue to decline until we get the policy right.
I should, for the sake of full disclosure, say that before I worked at the university where I'm currently employed, I did work for TDS for almost 10 years and for the local cable company, which was then called Complete Channel TV, which is now Charter, for about 10 years. So I'm not pro or anti any one of those companies. I still have retirement from TDS, and I hope to be able to use that when I actually do retire, so I hope they're still around. But I also get frustrated with things that, like the Monticello, Minnesota project. I tried to explain to TDS then that this is sort of the best of all worlds because instead of the phone company getting complaints about people digging up their yards and stomping on their flower beds, that the city would handle all that problem, and so you'd wash your hands of a lot of the problems that you get during the construction of a fiber optic construction project. Did TDS ever build fiber to the home in Monticello, or do you know?
They have. I don't know if they've done it to every home. They're certainly advertising it in some areas. It's not clear that they have passed everyone, but it's available to those who want it, from what I understand. And so they offer a very fast package as well. They offer a 50 megabit down and 20 megabit up for $50 a month is what I want to say. And this is a result. This is what you have with competition, right? I mean, and I don't want to come off sounding like I hate TDS or that I think TDS is evil, because TDS has a job to do. TDS's job is not to look out for the citizens of Monticello. It's not to look out for the citizens anywhere. Their job is to look out for their shareholders. And it's the local government's job. It's the county government's job. It's the state government's job. And it's the federal government's job to look out for the interests of people. And the problem is that the government hasn't been doing that, and the companies have been tremendous at looking out for their shareholder interests. And so that's my critique. And in the extent that we have communities that build these networks, we see that TDS can run a much faster network. They can invest. They can offer lower prices. But they don't do it unless the community builds a network and really creates competition, competitive pressure. Because TDS is happy fighting against Charter. They can divide the market up, but when you get a third party or more, then that's just not going to happen. It changes the dynamic, and you see these companies investing more. So the community networks have many benefits in terms of just providing faster connections themselves. They change the entire dynamic in a community, benefiting everyone.
There was a fascinating quote in the June 2009 multi-channel news from the CEO of Time Warner Cable TV about how when they look at the bundle of television and telephone and internet service, their customers' perception is that the internet is the foundation of all three services. So I think that's the way we're moving, and certainly the internet is something that's changed more than telephone or TV services. Television service hasn't changed really much since we've gotten to the point of, 116 analog channels or some variation of analog and digital channels, but they can't keep doubling their bandwidth every 3 or 4 years, whereas the technology to do internet just keeps getting better and better every so many years.
Well, you're absolutely right. And what's fascinating is as we get more HD channels, which is the only real change in video we've had until we get 3D, right? The change to HD has put a greater crunch on the cable systems. And so moving forward, if Charter wants to free up more broadband, if they want to improve their speeds to their customers, they have to make really hard decisions. Well, do we want to have all these HD channels? Are we going to have to remove a couple of HD channels or forego adding new HD channels in order to increase the available broadband? And so the constraints on the cable networks are much greater than we see in the fiber-to-the-home networks. You follow the hardcore technology stuff closer than me, I'm sure, but they don't even foresee a limit for the fiber optic capacity. It's not a matter of having reached it. They don't even know if there is one or where it is.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very tremendous, and so that's why it makes sense to be building these networks. These are great investments for local governments because they may take 5 years or even 6 or 7 years, sometimes longer, depending on the community, to pay off. But that network is still going to be effective in 20 years. This is a very long-term technology, you know. Cell phones change rapidly, right?
Right.
The wires that run the backbone of the internet, they do not change rapidly.
Well, so people the physical wires don't, but yeah, the electronics and the virtual networks that you build change all the time.
Right, but you're not changing the wires themselves.
Right.
When they're fiber optic, at that point you leave them. And so this is the thing that a lot of people, I think, have fear when they hear someone saying, "Oh, this technology will work in 20 years." Well, you know, the copper that they put in the line in the ground in the 1900s, some people are still using that today, and this is what we're talking about, very long-lived technology.
Where I work at the university, every September, the amount of internet that people use is just about double what it was the previous year. So, and we don't improve the bandwidth at just a single step per year. We watch the network on a daily basis, and as we need more, we'll tinker with a connection in Chicago or tinker with a connection in Milwaukee or something else that will give us more bandwidth. But usually we're about only 20% or 20 to 40% utilized at any one time, and if we start to get up near 50% utilization, we start to get worried and start adding more bandwidth or tinkering with the network somehow to get more bandwidth. And I know that that's not something that you can do in the and the technology of cable modems or DSL, the changes that are happening in those two markets or those two technologies are, as you move the DSL access module or the DSLAM closer to the user, you can increase the speed. And so what AT&T is doing in the Madison area is their U-verse project, where they put little DSLAMs real close to the houses and then run fiber optics back to their central offices. Interestingly enough, the U-verse DSLAMs are not covered by the sharing of the technology. So if you're using AT&T's wires but a different carrier, like, for instance, TDS sells a competitive local exchange service in Madison, you have to take it all the way back to the central office. So AT&T is able to offer a faster DSL speed than the competing companies like TDS.
Right. We see that in with Quest here, too, because you know AT&T doesn't want to share those services with anyone. And it's only in a few places where that 1996 framework still exists that they have to share it. It's really it's harder and harder to find. But actually, can I jump in real?
Yeah.
One of the things I think you said that's fascinating that hasn't been talked about very frequently is people will often say, well, do I really need much faster services than I have right now? And you might be hard-pressed to come up with ways in which your average person really needs much faster speeds than they can get from AT&T and Charter right now. Now, I think you can, but it's a debate. But what I think is more interesting is moving forward, what you just talked about in terms of dynamically changing the amount of bandwidth available, which is to say that I am a photographer. I really like taking photos. I take a lot of photos. And it would be great if once a week, maybe in a two-hour window, I paid for a much faster bandwidth so I could upload everything off of my computer and store it in the cloud. So if my house burns down or my computer gets stolen, that I still have that all backed up. And it makes sense from the business plan. It makes a lot more sense for me to be able to buy a short window of faster connectivity. I can pay less for that than I would if I had to pay for that faster connectivity all the time. And I think this is a model that could really benefit a lot of people. It could benefit a lot of businesses and whatnot, but you just can't do it over copper.
One of the technologies that is used is called QoS, or quality of service. And the idea behind quality of service is, if there's a limitation on bandwidth, then some streams across the Internet get better attention than others. Some go through better and some don't. And that's a way of charging more to people who want things like their photographs to be uploaded faster. But at the university where I work, we find that the cost of implementing QoS technology, and you have to have authentication technology because that way you only give the QoS to the people who pay for it. And, of course, you have to have a billing technology that can support that. And what we find is it's just about the same amount of money to build a faster network so that everybody just has a much broader bandwidth. So it's interesting. So I don't see the benefit of being able to burst unless you're doing an extraordinary project, like, for instance, the Large Hadron Collider over in Europe, when they want to send terabits of information, then they want to have a lot of bandwidth, but they don't need it all the time because they only do events, you know, every couple of months.
Right. Well, can I get back to
sure.
Lafayette quickly? So the Lafayette story was just terrific, where you had people coming out, and this video is just terrific. It's a used car salesman, and he's saying that this bicycle is functionally equivalent to a car. And this is something that I think is really relevant for people who hear the advertisements. I'm sure AT&T and Charter both use fiber in some point of their advertisements. They try to conflate their network with a fiber network. This is more common in communities where they're competing against Verizon. But I think that what we're talking about here is a whole different paradigm. And so the fiber networks are significantly different from the copper. It's not just a matter of faster speeds, but we can do so many more things with them. And I think my example of the photography and wanting to back up my computer quickly at one time, it's a little different from QoS, from the quality of service. And I think that you're absolutely right about your point of sometimes the cost of measuring is more expensive than just provisioning faster services. But I think what it comes down to in the end is that by moving to fiber, we can try a whole bunch of different things that are just impossible with copper. But the only way we can get to fiber is by making sure that AT&T isn't choosing the digital future of the community. And I think that's really a key point that we need to come back to. So I hope that makes some sense.
Okay, yeah, thank you. I don't know which direction to go off into, but one of the comments I was going to make is the commonly available fiber optic speeds for high bandwidth connections is 10 gigabits per second, and there's development in both the standard of for 40 gigabits or even 100 gigabits per second. So when that happens, that would affect backbone networks. So like, for instance, AT&T's connection from Chicago to Madison or the university's connection from Chicago to Madison. And when you're able to implement that, that will multiply either by 4 or 10 the amount of bandwidth you can get, and usually the cost doesn't go up as fast. I've discovered or found a fascinating statistic for the university. The university can purchase wholesale internet service, or it can connect directly to other people's networks. So one of the people we connect with is Google, and when you connect directly with their network, then you don't pay a wholesale provider to take your traffic to Google and bring Google's traffic back to you. So that saves both you and the other party money, so in this case Google. We increased our connection to Google to 10 gigabits per second in Chicago. And so the total amount of bandwidth that we buy, that we get for zero cost is 97.5%. And so we're paying for 2.5% of our traffic at this point, which it's a stunning achievement at Madison, and I don't know how long it will last because things ebb and flow constantly. But it was quite startling to realize that we still have to pay for the network that we built from Madison
right.
to Chicago, but that's a flat cost, and we don't pay based on usage on that. So we
right.
were all quite stunned about that number.
Yeah, it's amazing. When you compare with Google, the ability to get all that YouTube traffic for free is terrific.
Right.
A lot of savings involved there.
Right.
Which is actually, it's interesting in that the same principle applies down in Lafayette, where when they were building their network, they said, let's do something really interesting here. So if you connect to the Internet over Lafayette's network, you can either get a 10 megabit, a 30 megabit, which is $44 a month, or a 50 megabit, which is $57 a month, connection to the Internet. But no matter which connection you use to the Internet, if you're connecting to someone else on the local network in Lafayette, you get 100 megabits per second. And that's because it's the same principle that you just cite, which is that local traffic is pretty much free. There's no additional cost of having to go through another provider's network. And so I think it's a terrific opportunity for local media and for community media, which is to say that if I have created a really interesting audio show or video show in Madison, and most of the people who are going to be interested in listening to that or watching that in Madison, I can distribute that for free over a network that's designed this way.
Let me interrupt for a second. We have another caller, and I'd like to remind the listeners, if you would like to call in, there's just a few minutes left in the show, so give us a call at 256-2001. Go ahead, caller. You're on the air.
Yeah, I may have missed this earlier, but a few years ago, after the crash of the telecom companies and stuff like that, there was talk that there was a lot of dark fiber out there, that there was excess capacity that was not being used. So I'm just curious, how does that relate to overall cost, or are the existing fiber networks able to carry really all this traffic, and it's just a matter of the companies that own the networks determining prices and that kind of thing? Thanks.
Thank you for the call. That's a great question.
It is, and it's one we hear regularly. People are so confused because they say there's supposed to be all this dark fiber. Why don't I have fiber to my house? And the answer, unfortunately, is that dark fiber isn't in a place where it helps us to connect residentially in much faster speeds.
It's on the long haul.
Exactly, and so that's why you're able to interconnect with Google in so many places, because they've bought a lot of that. And so it's terrific for people who are doing that, those sort of long-distance connectivity. There's a lot of fiber in those corridors, but in terms of getting to someone's house, there's not a lot of fiber on their street. And so there's such a almost the entire cost of building a fiber-to-the-home network in a place like Madison is going to be the labor of getting the fiber from on the poles and then to the houses.
Yes. We'll pick up in a second if we get time, but we have another call. So go ahead, caller.
I had a question about MedCity Broadband.
Yes.
Whenever I've looked on the Internet, it seems like nobody has much good to say about them, and I'm wondering what is the deficiency of that network and how that, if that's something that has potential to be used.
They have a lot of promise. We talk with them frequently. In my position at the university and also in my quest for better community networks, they started out using broadband technology, using wireless technology by itself. And so if you were, if their connection to the outside world is in the downtown area and you live five blocks out on the west side, then your traffic would hop through three or four access points on the way from downtown to the remote locations. And when you have these distributed all over, it's called a mesh network because access points can talk to multiple other access points. But in the end, it doesn't give you high speed. It's lower cost than running wires to the home, but it can't compete with the cost of fiber. But MedCity Broadband is working with the university in a project that we call MUFFIN, the Madison Unified Fiber Network. And so they will be using that fiber to connect to their wireless access points so that neighborhoods will have a direct fiber feed back to the core of MedCity Broadband's network and will speed things up. They are also doing fiber optic connections to commercial customers like apartments and businesses. And a number of people like myself are trying to twist their arm into offering fiber optic to the home. And so that discussion is ongoing. So I hope that answers your question. Thanks, caller. Christopher, where were we?
I'm not sure where we left off, but I did want to let listeners know that I've just released the report. You mentioned the subtitle earlier, but I wanted to mention the full title. It's Breaking the Broadband Monopoly, How Communities Are Building the Networks They Need. It's very easy to find with a Google search. We got a good title that got us high in the Google rankings right away, so anyone who wants to check it out, there's a lot of really good information about what communities have done and why it makes sense. And it's a response in some ways to there's this general feeling that communities have done this poorly. And that's because there's so many groups out there funded by companies like AT&T that really they muddy the water and they confuse people by making poor comparisons and by suggesting that communities have failed at this. And the truth is that communities have done very well at this. And very few communities that have done this have regretted it. So there's a lot of potential out there. And there's a lot of other upsides that I cover in the report that we weren't able to talk about here, from public safety to where wireless is important, because wireless can't substitute for the wired connections, but it's a good complement. It's important for mobility. And then there's a very big discussion about competition in there and the need for that in the future.
There's never enough time, and we're running out of time quickly. So one of the questions I wanted to ask was about rural situations. In urban markets like Madison, you might have 70 homes per mile or 100 homes per mile. But when you got into suburban and rural areas, then the density of homes goes way down. And so therefore, you have to build longer lengths of fiber optic cable to get to those homes. Did you talk about that at all in your study?
I do talk about that. I talk about it in the terms of in a couple of different ways. The way I like to think about it is we have a lot of experience in making this work, running wires to people. This isn't the first time we're confronted with this problem. We built a telephone network to everyone. We built an electrical grid to everyone. And there's different approaches you can use in rural areas. But the key is in rural areas, is you really can't try to make a profit on basic infrastructure. And if you do, you're going to underserve people. And so in rural areas, there really needs to be a focus on public ownership, whether or cooperatives are terrific in rural areas, or nonprofits. Because if you have a company that's trying to make a profit in a rural area, they're really going to be cutting corners and charging people too much money, and that's just a real disservice to rural people.
A long time ago, there was a rural electrification administration, and the idea was to stimulate the economy and also to get telephone service to people who haven't had it previously, to farms and rural homes. And it was very successful. It was a very successful program, and that model should be continued, I think.
Right. I dedicated a page to drawing some lessons from that and refreshing people's mind in the report that I just did on that, and I think you're right. It might be the most successful government program in history. It's just, it's awe-inspiring that we were able to, in the midst of a depression and a great war, to connect so many people with the key telecommunicate or the key technology of their time.
Well, we're going to have to wrap it up. Could you give your organization's URL again one more time?
Sure. We're at newrules.org. It's the Institute for Local Self-Reliance. And I also I work at muninetworks.org for all our telecom work.
And thanks to Elizabeth Delaquest, our engineer. And now we jump into Democracy Now! Thanks for listening, everybody.
You are listening to WORT 89.9 FM in Madison, Wisconsin. Listener-sponsored community radio, and WORT-HD.
WORT thanks its listener sponsors and Just Coffee, Madison's Fair Trade Roasting Cooperative. Just Coffee buys fair trade coffee to ensure equitable conditions for coffee grower cooperatives around the world and roasts locally in small batches. More information at 204-9011 or on the web at justcoffee.coop.